Chapter 5 Louisa Wogan had been put into a waiting parlour. For once, Dr. Maturin's visitor was not wandering about the corridors in the Asclepia's usual haphazard way. But the door had been left open, and the Asclepia had come to her. The Emperor of Mexico and a couple of millionaires were gathered in the parlour, laughing merrily. They were polite lunatics, however, and when Mrs. Wogan sprang up, ran to Stephen, took him by both hands, and cried, "Oh, Dr. Maturin, how glad I am to see you," they filed out on tiptoe, each with his finger to his lips.
"How are you?" she went on. "You have not changed in the least."
Nor had she. Still the same pretty young woman. Black hair, blue eyes, lithe, like a plump boy, lovely complexion. She was wearing the sea otter furs that Stephen had given her on Desolation, down there towards the southern pole, and they had the happiest effect upon her looks.
"Nor have you, my dear," said he, "except to improve your bloom, your native air, no doubt, and proper nourishment. Tell me, how did you support the voyage?"
He had last seen her in a tolerably advanced state of pregnancy, and he feared for the child.
"Oh, pretty well, I thank you. The baby was born in the most appalling tempest. While we were going to and fro off Cape Horn, the men were all aghast, kept the deck, all of them, though the weather was quite unspeakable. But Herapath was very good, and afterwards everything was delightful. Such a pleasant run northwards from Rio, and the baby was so good. She had long, curling, dark hair from the very start."
"And Mr. Herapath?"
"He is very well, but he dared not come to see you, and I have left him at home with Caroline. But come, we cannot talk here. I mean to take you back. They do let you out, do they not?"
Stephen nodded.
"Then let someone fetch your great coat. It is amazingly cold outside, with a biting wind."
"I have no great coat. We are to be exchanged so soon that it is not worth the while, and I feel no inconvenience from the cold. Captain Aubrey charges me with his best compliments, and he is much distressed at being unable to pay them himself."
"Oh, him,"
said Mrs. Wogan, in a tone which made it clear to Stephen that the visit was intended for Dr. Maturin alone. At the same time, he recalled that the conditions of Mrs. Wogan's captivity aboard the Leopard were such that she could have no conception of their intimacy. But recollecting herself, she asked politely after Captain Aubrey's health, and hoped that he should soon be well. They went out into the front hall, where the porter came from his booth to open the door for them, an immensely tall and massive Red Indian, dressed in a suit of European clothes, one of the few unsmiling faces that worked in the Asclepia, invariably grave, sculptured, and apparently mute. Stephen addressed a civil "Ugh" to him, and as usual he received no reply, not even the slightest change of expression. But for the first time he did notice the lever that controlled the door, a comparatively simple arrangement, yet presumably enough to keep the madder patients in. Spring had come to Boston, spring at its most virulent, and as they walked across the common, an icy wind from Cambridge blew small, shattered green leaves into the half-frozen mud, while nearly all the Americans they passed, red, black, or bluish-grey, had streaming colds. But neither Maturin nor Wogan noticed it. They were lost in a flood of reminiscence. Their voyage, the comforters she had knitted him, the stockings, the battle, the ship near sinking, the frigid refuge on Desolation Island, sealskins, warmth and food at last, the coming of the American whaler in which Wogan and Herapath had made their escape. How was Mr. Byron, Mr. Babington, Mr. Babington's dear fool of a dog? Eaten, alas, by the natives of the Friendly Islands, but they had offered a maiden in exchange. What had happened to the gypsy woman and her baby, and to Peg? The one had found her husband at Botany Bay, the other a dense pack of lovers, women being in such short supply. And as they talked, Stephen observed that Mrs. Wogan showed no reserve of any kind towards him. She spoke as to an old friend, with the same openness and confidence of their days aboard the Leopard, and with even more, perhaps, as though their friendship had matured with time. He was glad of it, because he was really fond of Wogan. He admired her courage, he liked her prattle, and he found her an agreeable companion. But he was surprised. She was, after all, an intelligence agent, though not a very good one, and he had, in the naval phrase, stuffed her up with false information of a singularly lethal nature, and as far as he could tell, this stratagem had borne fruit in the form of a trail of dead or discredited spies. Yet there she was, warm, pressed close to his side, leaning on his arm, apparently devoid of resentment. Then, partly as a result of what she let fall and of what she did not say, and partly from his own reflections, it came to him that this was because she thought him guiltless. He had been an unwitting tool, manipulated by the wicked Captain Aubrey, that bluff-seeming Machiavel. Or had she never even learnt from the vague, the woolen-minded Herapath that the papers had passed to him through Stephen's hands?
"Watch out!" she cried, plucking him from under the wheels of a dray. "Really, my dear, you must watch out and keep to the sidewalk."
They returned to that interesting period of their stay on Desolation, when the whaler was ready to depart. She described her preparations with the utmost candour, and with a reminiscent glee, and she said,
"I so very nearly told you. I was sure you would not mind, being an Irishman and a friend to liberty, to America. Did you not guess when you saw my seaman's trousers? Would you have helped me if you had known?" "I believe I should, my dear," said he. "I was sure of it," she said, squeezing his arm. "I told Herapath so, but Lord, what a fuss he made about it. His honour, you know, and all that. Apart from anything else, he said he owed you money. I always knew northerners worshipped the dollar, but I would never have believed anyone could have made such a coil about small change. In the south, of course, it is quite different. I had to screech and bawl like a fishwife to shift him, oh Lord!"
At the recollection she began to laugh, that absurd, infectious laugh of hers that always gave Stephen pleasure. And now people turned in the street and smiled at her. A pause, with a few more inward gurgles of mirth, and then suddenly she cried,
"But you never told me you know Diana Villiers!"
"You never asked," said Stephen. "You know her too, I collect?"
"Heavens, yes," said Mrs. Wogan. "I have known her this age and more. We are amazingly close friends. Well, we were in London anyway, and I love her dearly. As I dare say you know, she is the particular friend of Harry Johnson, a man I know very well. We both come from Maryland. They will be in Boston on Wednesday. I long for you to meet him. He loves birds, too. When I reached the States at last, I told them all about you, and Diana cried out, 'But that is my Maturin!' And Harry Johnson said, 'It must be the same Maturin that wrote the paper about boobies.' Could it be boobies?"
They passed O'Reilly's Hotel, and two British officers who knew Stephen looked at him with open envy. They saluted, and Mrs. Wogan gave them a flashing smile.
"Poor fellows," she remarked. "It is dreadful being a prisoner. I must get Mrs. Adams to invite them."
"It is not so much the Englishmen that you dislike, then, but rather their government?"
"That's right," said Mrs. Wogan, "though, of course, I hate some Englishmen, too. But it is really their government I detest, and I dare say it is the same with you. Do you know, they hanged Charles Pole, the friend of mine in the Foreign Office I told you about long ago. Such a cowardly, despicable thing to do. They might have shot him." "Here we are," she said, steering him into a muddy street of small brick houses with lean hogs searching along its gutter. "Are we not squalid? It is the best poor Herapath can do for the present."
Poor Herapath was waiting for them in a sparsely furnished room, little less squalid than the street, and full of smoke. He greeted Stephen with a painful mixture of embarrassment and affection, hesitating to offer his hand until Stephen grasped it. He had aged since they parted on Desolation Island, and from his emaciated appearance Stephen supposed that he had returned to the abuse of opium. Yet he was essentially the same Herapath, and while Louisa went to fetch their baby, he showed Stephen his translation of Li Po with an eagerness that brought the days of the leopard's sick bay vividly to mind. The baby was an ordinary specimen of its kind, probably good at bottom, but it was angry at not having been fed. And while its parents argued the point in voices necessarily raised above the usual tone, it roared and howled again. Stephen gazed at its red and angry face, the successive or sometimes mingled expressions of woe and rage, and reproached himself for wishing it never had been born. He also noticed that Herapath was somewhat less inept at handling it, and that the little creature paid more attention to its father than its mother. Eventually, after the usual compliments, delivered in something near a shout, it was carried away, and Herapath said, "I am exceedingly concerned, Dr. Maturin, that I should have left you without paying my debt."
"Not at all," said Stephen. "I seized upon your property and sold your uniforms to Byron, who is naked and much of your size. You left me the richer for the bargain."
"I'm glad of that. It preyed upon my mind.
After all your kindness."
"Pray, Mr. Herapath, do you spend all your hours with Lippo? I had hoped you might perhaps study physic on your return. You have a real gift for medicine."
"And so I should, if I had the means. As it is, I've read Galen and what other books I can come at. But I hope that when my translation is published, the profits will allow me to return to Harvard and qualify myself as a physician. I have great hopes. Louisa has a friend, a childhood friend from the South, who has made interest with a Philadelphia publisher, and he gives me every reason to suppose that all will be well. The book may come out in a handsome quarto next year, with an octavo edition to follow, if the demand is great enough. In the meantime, we live upon an allowance that my father is good enough to make me. But if only he would—"
Herapath checked himself, coughed, and said, "My father desires me to make you his best compliments, and he hopes for the honour of your company at dinner tomorrow."
"I should be happy to wait upon him," said Stephen, rising.
For Mrs. Wogan had come back, followed by a slatternly black woman and two small black boys with the tea tray and its grubby appurtenances.
"I do hope it will be to your liking," said Mrs. Wogan, looking anxiously into the pot. "Sally is better at mint juleps than tea."
At one time Stephen had been marooned on a bare rock in the South Atlantic, and his only drink was the warm rainwater that remained in the guano-filled hollows. It had been more disagreeable than Mrs. Wogan's tea, but only very slightly so. The taste of his bitter cup stayed with him for the rest of the day, although he had endeavoured to qualify it by eating lumps of an amorphous grey substance said to be spoon bread, a southern delicacy. He was conscious of it when he woke in the morning, and he could still readily evoke the curious mixture of tar, molasses, and perhaps verdigris when Herapath came to the Asclepia to fetch him.
"Do you think, sir," said Herapath uneasily, "that I should pay my respects to Captain Aubrey?"
"I do not," said Stephen. "He would consider it his duty to hang you for having run from the Leopard, and the excitement, the agitation in his enfeebled state, would be very bad for him. I have just agreed with Dr. Choate that no visitors should be allowed, particularly the people from the Navy Department, who so upset him the other day."
The Navy Department had upset Jack Aubrey, but not very much. Not nearly so much as that distant victory off the Demerara River. Not nearly so much as the view from his windows, one of which commanded the harbour, and the other the moorings of the American men of war. It was not that a great deal happened, since all the merchantmen were tied up, sometimes too deep, all along the wharves, and little was to be seen in motion apart from small craft and fishing boats. But what did happen moved him as he had very rarely been moved before. Apart from the intervals of meals and medical care and the cleaning of his room, he spent the daylight hours with his telescope to his eye. He knew the powerful American frigates intimately well. He even knew a great many of their officers and men, quite apart from those officers from the Constitution whose acquaintance he had made during the voyage and who came to visit him, and he watched them with passionate intensity. Three of them, President, a 44-gun 24-pounder, wearing a Commodore's broad pendant, Congress, 38, and of course his own dismantled Constitution. And he had but to swing round and steady his glass on the other windowsill, and there in the offing he would catch the tagansels of the blockading squadron. Sometimes a frigate, Aeolus, or Belvedere, or Shannon, would come right into the outer harbour and reconnoitre, and his heart would beat so that he had to hold his breath to keep the glass from moving, beat with wild notions of a cutting-out attack, or a landing to carry the forts from behind. Constitution was undergoing massive repairs and alterations. He could not flatter himself that this was all owing to the damage that Java had inflicted, but she had certainly made her contribution, and the Constitution would not be a fighting ship for some months to come. The President and Congress, however, were rapidly preparing for sea, and he watched every move. He saw their rigging new set up, noted the seamanlike way in which the President re-rove her bowsprit gammoning in a single afternoon, saw their stores come aboard, hundreds and hundreds of casks, saw them complete their water, exercise their hands aloft, take in their powder from the hoy. They were almost on the wing, waiting perhaps for no more than a brisk southwester and the ebbing tide to shift the blockading ships far enough north and east to let them slip out into the Atlantic. It was when his glass had been long focused on President's quarterdeck, trying to make out the exact nature of her carronades, that he heard a remote cheering from the harbour. He turned quickly. He was nimble enough now, and every day he felt his strength returning, and there was another American frigate, standing in under topsails and jib. Somehow she had evaded the blockading squadron, although the wind was moderate, a little south of east, and had been so all day. Perhaps they were manned entirely by blind lunatics. But this was no time for recrimination. He levelled his telescope and stared, his whole being concentrated in that eye. A 38-gun frigate, fine entry, smooth run, 28 long 18-pounders, 24 30-pound carronades, 2 traversing long 18-pounders on her forecastle, and another on the quarter-deck. Deck pridded to the nines, falls Flemished. The Chesapeake. As he watched, an officer on her quarter-deck raised his speaking trumpet. Before he could hear the order, the frigate's jib and topsails vanished in one movement. She glided on in a long curve, stemming the tide, and picked up her moorings just as the way came off her. At the same moment, her starboard quarter-boat splashed down, the bargemen jumped into it, and her captain pulled ashore. It could not have been done better in any ship that Jack had served in, not even when old Jarvey had the Channel Fleet. The only thing that he could have taken exception to was the spectacle of 3 tall midshipmen leaning on the rail in nonchalant attitudes, chewing tobacco and squirting the juice over the side.
"Will you take your dinner now, sir?" asked Mary Sullivan. "'Twas twice Brady has been up, and you looking at your old boats. Do you wish it cold, for I love the good codfish? Well, well, eat it up while there's some warmth to it still. There now. And the doctor is having his dinner in the town, so he is. God bless him."
Mr. Herapath Sr. was a big, authoritative man, big in his chest, shoulders, and belly, with a large, florid face and even larger features. His hair was powdered, and he wore a black velvet coat with blue collar and cuffs, a combination of colours that brought Diana Villiers even nearer to the forefront of Stephen's mind. In a little less than 27 hours, he reflected, glancing at a handsome English clock, she would be in Boston. Mr. Herapath's manner was firm and assured. He was obviously accustomed to command, and both his son and the elderly lady who kept house for him sank into mute insignificance. But to Stephen he was markedly amiable, welcoming, and even deferential. He apologised for not having come to the Asclepia to pay his respects to Dr. Maturin, and to thank him for his great goodness to Michael. He had been kept within doors by a wretched colic, but it was gone now, and he was very happy to have this opportunity of making his acknowledgments. He could never sufficiently congratulate himself upon Michael's having been honoured with the acquaintance and of having come under the influence of such a distinguished man. Dr. Rawley had spoken to him of Dr. Maturin's valuable publications on the health of seamen, and he understood that Dr. Maturin was a fellow of the Royal Society. He was only a merchant himself, but he honoured learning, useful learning. Dinner was a long, slow, massive affair, and the conversation was almost entirely carried on by Mr. Herapath and Stephen. Michael Herapath said very little, and Aunt James confined herself to asking Stephen whether he believed in the Trinity.
"Certainly, ma'am," he replied.
"Well, I'm glad someone does," said she. "Nearly all these scoundrels at Harvard are Unitarians, and their wives are worse."
After that, she produced no more than hissing noises at the servants, and although she was no great conversationalist, she was clearly a notable housekeeper. The fog outside made the whole day dim, yet the big, comfortable dining room was alive with the subdued gleam of polished wood. The noble fire, flanked by brass that would have done credit to the Royal Navy, lit up a great expanse of Turkey carpet, red and blue. They ate their good, sober dinner off uncommonly massive plate, and when she left them, Stephen observed that she passed into an equally agreeable drawing room. It was not an elegant house, although there were some fine things in it, but it was discreetly rich and above all comfortable. He might have been dining with a long-established merchant in the City of London. This impression was much strengthened, startlingly strengthened indeed, when Mr. Herapath filled his glass, passed the decanter, rose to his feet and proposed the health of the king. Michael Herapath drank the toast with an abstracted look, and Stephen perceived that he was gliding a silver tablespoon into his pocket, the pocket away from his father's chair. Mr. Herapath then proposed, "A decent end to Mr. Madison's war, and may it come very soon," and Stephen followed him with, "Trade's increase," which Mr. Herapath drank in a bumper, thumping his glass three times on the table to show the heartiest agreement. In the drawing room, Stephen eyed the silver urn with some apprehension, but it appeared that in Boston they knew how to make tea, and he drank it gratefully, for his head was not unaffected by the amount of claret and port he had drunk. Only two cups, however, for Mr. Herapath was restive. He asked Aunt James whether it were not time for her nap, and upon this the poor lady walked straight out of the room without a word, leaving a half-mumbled piece of muffin. Then he told Michael that it was high time he returned to Caroline, since that Maryland Sally could not be trusted to feed her regularly, nor could anyone else, that he would see Dr. Maturin back to the Asclepia himself, and that Michael had better look sharp. The fog was getting thicker still.
"There, Dr. Maturin," he said at last, leading his guest into a small room, presumably his study, for there were half a dozen books in it, as well as ledgers. "Let me draw your chair to the fire. I cannot tell you how pleased I am to see you here."
After a pause, during which he looked at Stephen with a bright and eager eye, he stated that in the War of Independence he had been a loyalist, and that although to protect his interests he had returned from Canada, compounding with the Republic, his heart remained where it had always been.
"My conduct may not have been very heroic, sir, but though I'm only a merchant, not a hero. Heroism can, I believe, be very safely left to you gentlemen who serve the crown."
Still, he and his friends had done all they could to prevent Mr. Madison's war. Here followed some pretty bitter remarks about Mr. Madison, Mr. Jefferson, and the Republicans, and now they were doing all they could to hamper its progress and to bring it to an early close. He would have invited some of his friends, Tories and Federalists, to meet Dr. Maturin today, but that he wanted to express his gratitude first, and Dr. Maturin might have found that embarrassing in the presence of company.
"And because you wanted to weigh me up, old fellow," thought Stephen.
He wondered at Herapath's simplicity in expecting to be accepted at his own self-declared value, yet he also found it quite agreeable, since he had independent evidence of its truth. And he waited, nodding, agreeing, for the proposition that he sensed at no great distance.
"I'm always glad to see a British officer," said Mr. Herapath, "and I, my friends, have had the honour of entertaining several. But none has been of your weight and seniority, my dear sir, and none has had such claims on my esteem and gratitude. When my son returned, sir, he talked perpetually of you, of how you had raised him from the lowest rank to the quarter-deck, and of your kindness to him on all occasions. He was particularly unhappy that he should have left you without a word, and that he should have run away when he was in your debt. Would to God he had stayed. However, you must allow me to settle his debt at once. May I ask?"
"He owed me £7, said Stephen.
Mr. Herapath heaved sideways to reach his pocket, laid down the sum, and said,
"Let me add, sir, that my purse is always open to you, within reason,"
he added automatically, and went on.
"At least he was my son in hating debt, but in everything else, good Lord above, he spent years studying the Chinese language, sir. But will you believe me when I say it was the Chinese of 1,000 years ago, of no use to man or beast? He cannot even make out a bill of lading. And there were some other most unfortunate events. Then to crown all, he comes home from his travels not only naked, but with a drabble-tail wench from Maryland into the bargain, and a bastard child. I ask you, sir, what can I make of a son like that?"
"You can make him a physician, sir. He has considerable natural gifts in the physical line, and a keen intelligence. I was much impressed by his cool capability when he served as my assistant in the Leopard, often in very trying circumstances. And I do most earnestly beg you will consider the suggestion."
"Is he really capable of becoming a physician?"
asked Mr. Herapath, looking pleased.
"He often spoke of it when he first came home."
"Certainly he is," said Stephen. "His Chinese may be 1,000 years old, but you are to consider that Greek and Latin are older still.
They are required in a physician, because the wisdom of ages has found that they give a nimbleness of mind. They supple the mind, sir. They render it pliant and receptive. He has Latin and Greek, and he has Chinese, too. There is suppleness. There is pliability and receptiveness, I believe.
He often spoke of going to medical school. But to be frank with you, doctor, I do not like to trust him with the money. His connection with Mrs. Wogan is very painful to me, and since I believe that she has interested motives, I mean to starve her out. I should go a more decided way about it and have her taken up as a vagabond if it were not for what is, after all, my grandchild, Caroline. A most remarkable baby, Dr. Maturin.
I had the pleasure of seeing her yesterday.
Ah, had you known her dear great-grandmother, you would have seen the likeness directly. You would certainly have remarked upon it. A delightful child, such pretty ways. So you understand, sir, I am obliged to make Michael an allowance, not to lose Caroline. And although, of course, I cannot receive Mrs. Wogan publicly, I do see her from time to time. But my visits are very rare, and the allowance is very small. Do you think my course is well advised, sir? I shall be grateful for your opinion.
Stephen considered. He could do no harm. He might possibly do some good. He said,
I believe you are wise, sir. Yet I believe you would be wiser still in sending Michael to the medical school.
And then, since the words might reinforce the possible good, although they were blasphemy to him as a lover, he added,
A connection of this kind rarely fails to die away when it is coupled with possession and with prolonged discouragement, and above all, if an engrossing new interest, such as medicine, enters into competition with it.
Perhaps you are right. Yes, yes, I believe you are right. Doctor Herapath, ha ha! But do you really suppose he could qualify himself?
Stephen spoke of medical studies, instanced men barely capable of telling right from wrong, who had passed through them with success, and stated that he had no doubt but that one who had mastered Chinese could do as much and more. He felt that he had made his point, and when Mr. Herapath moved on to some tolerably illiberal abuse of Mrs. Wogan, and of women from the southern states in general, Mr. Herapath would not say this except to a physical gentleman, but it seemed that they were insatiable, sir, insatiable, he listened without contradicting.
"'Yet has Mrs. Wogan no sources of income other than the allowance you mention?'
he asked after a while.
"'I noticed that she kept three servants, which in England would argue a certain modest ease.
"'That vile Sally and the footboys? Oh, they're only slaves, sent up from her cousin's place near Baltimore. She would sell them if she could. That is not so easy in Massachusetts. And anyhow, who would buy such a parcel of slabbity-gullions? And so I have to feed the whole eternal pack of bone-idle good-for-nothing brutes.'
"'Baltimore is in Maryland, is it not?'
"'Yes, sir, right up the Chesapeake. Good tobacco land and worthless people.
"'Do you know of a Mr. Henry Johnson who comes from those parts?'
"'Why do you ask?'
said Herapath sharply.
"'Have you heard anything about him?'
"'Mrs. Wogan mentioned his name. It appears that he is acquainted with friends of mine.'
"'Oh, I thought maybe—'
Mr. Herapath's voice died away. He coughed and went on.
"'Well, now, Mr. Harry Johnson is a very wealthy man. He probably owns more slaves than anyone else in the state. He is a great Republican, and many of his friends are in power. He is counsellor to the Secretary of State, and he is often here in Boston. I keep my eye on him, because he knows Louisa Wogan. And to tell you the truth, sir,'
lowering his voice,
"'I hope he may rid me of her. He is the greatest whoremaster in the South. But at the same time, I'm very much afraid she might take my Caroline with her.'
"'I have a certain, perhaps unfounded impression,' said Stephen, "'that Mrs. Wogan is a somewhat detached parent. "'There may be a relative lack of that instinctive storge "'which equally binds the she-bear and the matron to their puling young.'
"'She is an unnatural cat,' said Mr. Herapath.
"'And there the conversation languished. "'Mr. Herapath fell to poking the fire with savage stabs.
"'I mentioned my friends some time ago.' "'Dr. Maturin,'
he said at last,
"'much good may come of a meeting, "'since they are all gentlemen of a like mind with me. "'Would you come tomorrow? "'We should like to make our sentiments known in Halifax as soon as possible, "'to convey them by means of a man of real weight and consequence, "'and you will be exchanged very soon, as I suppose. "'We have information to give, not indeed of a military, "'but rather of a political nature that may be of the first importance "'in bringing this war to an end.' Some of my friends are among the most important merchants in New England, and they know a great deal in the political and commercial line. We are all suffering from this war. For example, I have 3 ships tied up here in Boston and 2 more at Salem. But do not suppose, sir, that our motives are entirely selfish. We are concerned for our trade, it is true. But there are motives far higher than any trade.
I am convinced of it, sir, said Stephen. Yet, Mr. Herapath, you are a former loyalist. Your opinions cannot be unknown to the authorities, and the most elementary prudence requires that they should watch your house.
If they were to watch all the households in Boston that are opposed to Mr. Madison's war, they would need a couple of regiments.
But not all these households include an eminent citizen, the proprietor of 5 considerable vessels. I should be happy to give your friends the meeting, but I had rather it took place in some discreet tavern or coffee-house.
I own more than that, said Mr. Herapath. However, you may be right. It may be wiser. I honour your caution, Dr. Maturin. It shall be so.
In order that it might be so, he walked Stephen home a roundabout way that took them past the harbour. He pointed out 2 of his barks tied up against the wharf, their tall masts reaching up until they were no more than a faint trace in the fog.
That is Arcturus, he said. 1,700 tons burden. And the other Orion, a little better than 1,500. If it were not for this damned war, they would be plying to the Far East and back, out by the Cape for Canton, and home by the East Indies and the Horn, with 3,000 tons of silks and tea and spices, with China under all. But much as I respect the gentlemen of the Royal Navy, I cannot afford to offer them prizes of that value. So here they lie, with nothing but a couple of shipkeepers in them. Joe! He shouted. What now? Called Joe from out of the fog. Mind your fenders! I am a-minding of them, ain't I?
God's my life, said Herapath to Stephen, to speak to the owner so, and a black man at that. It could never have happened in the old days. With his democratical notions, that wicked fellow Jefferson has rotted the moral fibre of the whole country.
Jefferson, who had prompted Joe's reply, lasted until they reached a tavern. A quiet, respectable place, frequented by shipmasters, which would do very well for their meeting. And then, having impressed the place on Stephen's memory, Herapath led him up the hill through a series of alleys.
"How well you know your way," said Stephen.
"It would be strange if I did not," replied Herapath. "My sister Putnam has been in Dr. Choate's care these many years, and I visit her every new moon. She is a werewolf."
"A werewolf," said Stephen to himself.
And he turned it over in his mind until they went up a flight of steps and the familiar building came in sight. At the gates of the Asclepia they uttered expressions of mutual esteem, and Mr. Herapath left his best compliments for Captain Aubrey if, in view of his son's conduct, they should be acceptable, together with an offer of any assistance that the captain might stand in need of.
"I should dearly love to show my gratitude," he said, "for although Michael may not be all I could wish, he is my son, and Captain Aubrey preserved him from drowning."
"Perhaps you would like to walk in for 5 minutes," said Stephen. "The captain is not well enough for a longer visit, but I believe it would do him good to see you. He loves to talk of ships with those who understand them, and in spite of the circumstances to which you refer, he retains an affectionate memory of your son."
The captain was asleep when they came into the room, asleep with a look of deep unhappiness on his face, and the face was pallid, unhealthy, the long-established tan faded to a nasty yellow, the breathing laboured, with a rail that Stephen did not like to hear at all.
"What you need, my friend," he said to himself as they stood there, "is a victory, even quite a small victory, by sea. Otherwise you will eat your heart out, puel into a decline. Failing that, I believe we must try more steel and bark. Steel and bark."
"Why, Stephen, there you are,"
said Jack, opening his eyes wide awake at once, as he always was.
"So I am, too, and I have brought Mr. Herapath with me, the father of my assistant who behaved so very well during our epidemical distemper. Mr. Herapath also served the king in the former war, and he is the owner of several eminent ships, 2 of which you have remarked upon. They can be seen from this window here."
"Your servant, sir," said each, and Jack went on. "Those 2 fine barks with a Nelson checker and pole topgallant masts, the finest in the harbour?"
Mr. Herapath made his acknowledgments for Jack's preservation of his son, and they fell to talking of the ships. Herapath had made several voyages. He loved the sea, and he was a more amiable person here than in his own house. Their conversation was animated and free.
Sitting by the window and looking at the fog, Stephen drifted far away. In less than 24 hours, Diana would be here. Images of her moving, walking across the room, riding, setting her horse at a fence, flying over with her head held high. A distant clock struck the hour, followed by several more.
"Come, gentlemen," he said.
"What a fine fellow," cried Herapath as Stephen led him down the stairs. "The very type of the sea officer when I was young. No coldness, no pride, nothing like those army men. And a prodigious fighting captain. How well I remember his action with the Cacafuego. Oh, if only Michael could have been like him."
"I liked that man," said Jack.
"He did me good. He knows his ships from stem to stern, and he has sound political ideas. He hates a Frenchman as much as I do. I should like to see him again. How did he ever contrive to have such a son?"
"Your own may turn into a bookworm, or a Methodier parson," said Stephen. "'Tis just as the whim bites, no more. For, as you know, one man may lead a horse to the water, but 10 cannot make him think. But tell me, Jack, how do you feel? And how did you spend your afternoon?"
"Pretty well, I thank you. I saw the Chesapeake come in, one of their 38s. A beautiful ship. I suppose there must have been fog out there, too, beyond the bay. Anyway, she passed our squadron and came in fine style. She's lying beyond the President, near the ordnance quay. You will see her when it clears."
While Stephen took his pulse, he told him more about the Chesapeake and about the progress on the other frigates. And then he said,
"By the way, I had a luminous idea. Those Navy Department fellows are all to seek. I have been working it out with an almanac, and I find that at the time I am supposed to have brought their Alice B. Sawyer to, Leopard was tearing along at 12 or 13 knots with a Dutchman in her wake. It is materially impossible that I should have brought anything to. I'm quite easy in my mind."
"Bless you," said Stephen.
And in one of his very rare bursts of confidence, he went on, "I wish I could say the same. Diana will be in Boston shortly, and I'm wondering what course to pursue, whether to inflict myself upon her, perhaps unwelcome, perhaps untimely, or whether to affect a frigid indifference and let her make the first step, always provided that she should choose to do so and that she knows of our being here."
"Lord, Stephen," cried Jack.
But no more, until recollecting himself, he sat up and reached for a letter on his bedside table.
"Speaking of the devil, here is a note for you. Perhaps it is from her. Our capture was in the papers. Though I must not say the devil," he added after a pause. "She behaved very handsomely, writing home to tell Sophie we were alive, and I shall always think kindly of her."
It was not from Diana. Louisa Wogan asked dear Dr. Maturin to call on her. She would be alone any time after 10 o'clock, and she had a great deal to say to him. But before Stephen had time to make any comment, Dr. Choate and his patients, 2 doors away, struck into the triumphant opening bars of the Clemente C Major Quintet, playing with a sustained virtuosity and joy that kept their listeners silent until the sombre disenchantment of the finale. Mrs. Wogan was, as who should say, alone, since she did not count the occasional presence of her slaves, and Michael had taken Caroline to see her grandfather. She had, rather touchingly, dressed for the occasion, and Stephen noticed an emerald ring of surprising size and beauty. Their conversation was long, and on Louisa Wogan's side, remarkably frank. She reminded Stephen of the growth of their friendship, of his distress at the prospect of war between England and the United States, of his support for liberty in Ireland, Catalonia, Greece, and any country where freedom was threatened, of his abhorrence of the English way of pressing American sailors, and of his kindness to the American whalers on Desolation Island. They were, she said, much attached to him. She then went on to say that, as Stephen knew, she had been educated in France and had lived much in Europe. She had been intimately acquainted with some of the most interesting and influential men in Paris and London, and for this reason she had been able to advise certain American representatives abroad. She possessed the languages, local information, and introductions that were valuable to them. They had consulted her, and they had even given her confidential missions to perform. Their aim had always been the maintenance of peace and of their country's liberty. It was in the course of one of these missions that she had fallen foul of the English law. That was why she was sent to Botany Bay. The English had wanted to hang her, but fortunately she had friends who saved her neck. Botany Bay was an amazingly savage punishment for what in fact amounted to very little, yet at least she had thought she was shot of those odious British intelligence people. But not at all. Their malice pursued her even aboard the Leopard. Did Stephen remember some papers in French that were supposed to have been found among a dead officer's belongings, and that the captain gave to Michael Herapath to write out? Stephen had a vague recollection of such a task.
"You would not remember, would you?" she said with an indulgent smile. "You were too busy with your stormy petrels."
But then her face grew dark, and she said,
"They were completely false. I have a pretty good idea of who fabricated them, with the help of the people in London, and indeed in my own heart I am quite sure he is one of them, though I did not suspect him at the time, with his open, rather stupid sea-dog airs. Most of them are Freemasons, you know. Anyhow, it was my obvious duty to get copies, and so I did. And when I went off in the whaler, there they were in my bosom, and I was so pleased and proud."
She began to laugh, low and then fuller and fuller, so amused at the backward sight of herself, ridiculously pleased and proud of her poisoned documents. Sally looked in, grinned, and withdrew. Stephen contemplated Mrs. Wogan, and Mrs. Wogan's heaving bosom. She might be an inept intelligence agent, but he admired her dash and courage. He loved her acute, her wonderfully rare sense of humour. He had a real affection for her, and at present a distinct carnal inclination for her person. The long, long chastity of these recent voyages weighed upon him. He was particularly conscious of her scent, her supple roundnesses, her propinquity on this shabby but convenient sofa. Yet something told him that this was not the moment, that if in former times he might have risked no very severe rebuff, he certainly risked it now. He neither stirred nor spoke.
"But it was no laughing matter," she said at last. "When I reached the States with my papers, everyone was delighted, amazed and delighted. But then dreadful things began to happen. I will not go into all that now. But Charles Pole was hanged, and Harry Johnson very nearly lost his place. He fairly hates Captain Aubrey and the Leopard."
"The Mr. Johnson who knows Diana Villiers, and who is to come so soon?"
"Yes. They always take the first floor of Franchon's Hotel. It is being cleared out for them at this very minute. Such a remue-ménage. I long for you two to meet. I am sure Harry Johnson would value your advice. He would love to consult you. When we parted, and when you gave me those lovely furs, I so very nearly told you about him. I wish I had."
"I shall be happy to meet Mr. Johnson," said Stephen.
"I shall take you to see him tomorrow."
Emerging from Wogan's Warren, Stephen reached a broad street full of citizens in greatcoats and fur caps, chewing tobacco. There was one, however, a middle-aged man in a sheepskin cloak and a broad-brimmed hat, who was not doing so. And as Broadbrim paced soberly between the jets, Stephen asked him the way to Franchon's Hotel.
"Come, friend, and I will show thee," said the American. "Thou dost not seem to feel the cold," he observed as they walked along.
"I am not insensible to it, however," replied Stephen, "having recently come from a warm climate."
"There," said the American,
stopping opposite a large, white-painted, elegant building with balconies running across its front.
"That is the house of the Whore of Babylon. Thou art neither so young nor so foolish as to enter into it. But if thou dost, friend, mind thy poke."
"He that is down needs fear no fall," said Stephen. "He that is low, no pride. My poke is empty, and no man can rob me."
"Art in earnest, friend?" said the American, looking at him attentively.
Stephen nodded, but then, seeing the man's hand go to his pocket, he cried,
"No, no, I have plenty in a drawer at home. Thank you, sir, for having shown me the way, and thank you for what I believe to have been your kind intent."
Stephen stood there for a while after the American had left him. All things being considered, the Whore seemed to do herself pretty well. A comfortable place, no doubt, though somewhat richer than he would care for himself. The kind of place where he might eat if invited by wealthy friends, but not alone. The first floor was indeed being turned inside out. Pieces of furniture, carpets, rugs appeared on the long balcony, moving from room to room, and judging by the passionate cries that accompanied every movement, the hotel was run by French people. good food and wine in all likelihood, if one did not mind the cost. It would suit Diana perfectly. As he watched, he saw Pontecanet come out, pause on the sidewalk, and call up to a man on one of the upper balconies.
"Yankee Doodle!" he cried, and laughed aloud. "Yankee Doodle, souviens-toi!"
Stephen melted into the crowd and hurried off to his meeting at the Quayside Tavern, where, as he had expected, nothing awaited him at this stage but circumspection, generous statements of no binding quality, and vehement abuse of Mr. Madison. The only solid information he received was that Constellation, a 38-gun frigate of 1,265 tons, cost $314,212 to build at Baltimore, whereas the Chesapeake, also of 38 guns, cost only $220,677 at Norfolk.
£61,299.02,
said Mr. Herapath, looking at his notebook, "and a dead waste of public money." For his part, Stephen was perfectly non-committal. Who could tell what private animosities there might be among these merchants, to say nothing of the possible agent provocateur? As he walked back to the Asclepia, his mind ran chiefly upon Mrs. Wogan. She intended to present him to Johnson as her new recruit. Consultant was the term she used, nothing so coarse or injurious as spy, adviser in the cause of peace. He had expressed nothing but a general interest, but her wishes had outrun her judgment, and she was almost sure of him. Mistakenly, as it happened, since he did not intend to play the double agent. He had seen it done, sometimes with spectacular results, but it was not for him, even if he had the necessary skill, which he doubted. There was the danger of being caught by friendship on the other side, or by scruples, and above all there was the obligatory extreme depth of dissimulation, and he was sick of it. Sick of it all. He was sick even of simple dissimulation, dissimulation at one level, and he longed to be shot of it, to be able to speak openly to any man or woman he happened to like, or to dislike for that matter. Yet he would have to see Johnson. Again, just as Pretty Wogan had now persuaded herself that he would be an adviser, so in the past her partiality for him had blinded her, so that Jack appeared as the villain of the piece, a belief that was apparently shared by her superiors, and that would account for many things. Their unwillingness to let him go, their retention of his papers, the odd business about the Alice B. Sawyer, which might be a blundering first attempt at a trumped-up charge. He wondered what they might possess in the way of scruples. Some intelligence services he had known let their desire for revenge and further information carry them very far indeed. Bonaparte's agents had no limits at all. He twitched his hands, still crooked and twisted from a French interrogation many years ago. As far as the nations went, he did not think that there was the least parallel between the United States and France. The States had an active and vocal public opinion. He had read their papers, mostly written in a steady shriek of indignation, with astonishment, whereas the extremely efficient tyranny in France had almost entirely gagged it, and in any case the whole concept of government and of public morality was so entirely different. Yet intelligence services were something else again, little worlds of their own, often inhabited by strange, extreme beings. He knew something of the French and Spanish. He had seen the English in the Dublin of 1798 and the riding school in Stephen's Green, where suspects were put to the question. Infamous creatures, most of the questioners. But even honourable, humane men were capable of almost anything for unselfish motives. On the other hand, the effects of the bomb that Wogan had so proudly carried home would have been felt primarily in France. It was essentially directed at Bonaparte, and only incidentally at the Americans as his potential allies. The American agents would have suffered in their pride, not in their persons. He found Jack Aubrey sitting on a chair by the window, surveying the harbour with his telescope.
"You've just missed Mr. Andrews," he cried on seeing Stephen. "If you had been a few minutes earlier, you would have caught him. Indeed, I wonder you did not run into him on the stairs."
"Who is Mr. Andrews?"
"He is the new agent for prisoners of war, and he came to deliver a protest. He came from Halifax in that slab-sided ketch by the Red Boys, and he brought some papers and this note for you. No letters from England yet, at least not for us."
The note was from Stephen's colleague in Halifax. To all appearance it contained no more than a brief account of the death of a common friend. In fact, it told him that Jean Dubreuil was in Washington. Jean Dubreuil was an important man in Paris, and he was one of those Stephen had hoped to kill or disable with his bomb. He put the letter back in his pocket and attended to Jack, who was telling him about the blockade.
"Africa is laid up," he was saying, "and Belvedere sprung her mainmast a little above the partners, so we only have Shannon and Tenedos in Massachusetts Bay. Just those two and a tender, a sloop, to watch their President, Congress, Constitution, and now Chesapeake. To be sure, Constitution is laid up, and Chesapeake is alongside the sheer hulk, getting in a new main and mizzen, but President crossed her royal yards this afternoon, and Congress is pretty well ready for sea. She has her powder in, as I told Mr. Andrews."
"Did you tell him much?"
"Every single thing I have learnt, with all this staring. And since, thank God, I have a very good glass, I have learnt a great deal. For example, Chesapeake landed 4 carronades and an 18-pounder, but she still has her full armament for a 38. I fancy she must have been overgunned and worked heavy in a sea. But there were several things I forgot while I was talking to him. I must note them down in future."
"Jack, Jack, do nothing of the kind," cried Stephen, and moving over to sit by him, he went on in a low voice,
"Put nothing whatsoever down on paper, and take great care how you talk. For I must tell you this, Jack. The Americans suspect you of being concerned with intelligence. That is why the exchange is delayed. Do not, for God's sake, give them a handle to proceed against you. This is spying. But do not be too concerned, however. Do not let it disturb your mind. It will all blow over, I am convinced. Even so, you would be well advised not to show too much blooming health. You must keep to your bed, and you may exaggerate your weakness. You may swing the lead a trifle. You must not see these officials if it can be avoided. I will have a word with Dr. Choate."
He gave some quick, expert hints on malingering.
"But do not be concerned. As I say, it will soon blow over."
"Oh,"
said Jack, laughing heartily for the first time since their captivity.
"I am concerned. If they suspect me of intelligence, I am sure it will soon blow over. Ha, ha, ha!"
"Well," said Stephen, smiling, "you are not above playing on words, I find. So good night to you now. I'm going to turn in early, because I, too, wish to be intelligent tomorrow."